This is Bird Note. Solar panels are a popular source of renewable energy. But large groupings of them, called arrays, can take up a lot of space, says ecologist Chelsea Prather.
People are interested in making that area underneath solar arrays into usable habitats. So it's really important to know who is using it and how they're using it.
At two solar arrays in Ohio, Chelsea and her students found American robins, or rather their cup-shaped nests. The first site was a fixed array with panels that are locked in place. The second was a tracking array where panels tilt to follow the sun. Chelsea noticed that robin nests on the tracking array looked weird. Measurements confirmed that these nests were unusually tall and mounted to the support beams at odd angles.
And we think that was just because the nest was moving throughout the day when they were trying to make the nest.
And the taller walls may have stopped the eggs from falling out, too. It's a new example of how birds are adapting to a changing world.
Nature finds a way. These birds are making their nests that contain their precious eggs on a structure that is moving all the time, and they have found a way to do it, which I think is just remarkable.
For Bird Note, I'm Ariana Rimmel.
You are listening to CJSF 90.1 FM. Broadcasting from Burnaby Mountain, British Columbia.
Hello and welcome to the Canadian Philosophy Show. I'm your host, Brandon, and I'm joined today by Hale. Today, we are going to continue our theme of reading and discussing and exploring sort of media studies, new media, by looking at a text by one of the, not just a philosopher, not even just a thinker or a theoretician, but an actual practitioner. In fact, one of probably the most important practitioners of what we would today call advertising or public relations or PR. Today we are going to be discussing and reading Edward Bernays' book, Propaganda, which obviously is about propaganda, but it's about propaganda in lots of different ways, as we'll explore. So I just wanted to introduce Edward Bernays a little bit, just by way of, because I think that Bernays, as far as a character goes, it factors a lot into how to read this text particularly and how to gauge the sort of industry, I guess you could say, the industry that Bernays ultimately spawns, what was called public relations consultation, but we would today, it previously would have been called propaganda. He has to redeem it, so he calls it something else. Now we would probably have a hard time distinguishing from advertising, but Bernays will say that there's a distinction between advertising and PR, and we'll explore that. Basically, Bernays was, I want to say, just as far as biographically, he was the nephew of Sigmund Freud. So he's going to, and he's playing upon a lot of the ideas that Sigmund Freud introduces him to, things like psychology and the way that desire subconsciously influences the way that we do things. The other thing too is that specifically Bernays being related to Freud and having to move to America in order to sort of escape the conditions of Europe at the time. He goes there before World War II, and he's living in America and working in this way. He didn't just come up to this sort of theoretically. He was practicing this, and this was his career for essentially his entire life. He mingled around New York and found himself working for various corporations, making some important social changes, but not for the reasons that I think we're used to seeing philosophers or others make social changes. Bernays more or less does enact social changes at the behest of, say, like, being hired to change attitudes about smoking. Bernays is an important figure in terms of like media studies, but was there anywhere in particular that you encountered propaganda as a text?
That's a good question. Honestly, I can't think of a particular moment. It's what, you know, you and I, as you stated earlier, have been doing media shows for a while now. We've covered a lot of different folks. And Bernays is someone that has come up many times from other theorists that we've read or have, like, they've discussed or mentioned, because I think through this book and and his whole career, really, but this book is probably the best and most like literal example, and it's got some really interesting layers that I'm sure we'll get into. It was really the thesis that the thesis, and we can even read a little bit from the text, it's this thesis, okay, you know, the public is always controlled in some kind of way. Well, you know, that used to be through marriage alliances or fear or violence or just, you know, wealth or whatever, right? You can think about all sorts of different social systems and stuff. Bernays points out that societies have gotten really large. Like, he's writing, the propaganda was published in 1928. And so Bernays is talking at a time with the advent of a lot of modern media. And obviously he's writing for the United States, a very large society. So basically, you know, he's like, look, there's always going to be some public control of the public. There are ways to, you know, through group psychology, through basically scientific methodology, there are ways that those in power or those of influence or those who want to have particular influence can basically use, there's a toolkit for control, for convincing people. It doesn't involve literal coercion. It involves convincing and making people, more importantly, believe that their wants and desires and thoughts are actually like their own, and therefore they're going to be like committed members of whatever movement or product or whatever you're going to have. So there's that level. I think this, and I think for so many of the later theorists that we've read, it's this like blatant, you know, coming out and basically saying, like, you using media, you can control the public, right? And basically everyone that we've read since then has agreed with that, with that thesis on some level or the other. That doesn't necessarily mean they agree that it's, like, morally correct or people should be doing it or whatever, but it is functionally a thing. And I think, too, that, you know, considering our own, as we record this and discuss in 2025, you know, this has become ever more the case. However, there are, I think as we'll get into it, there are some interesting changes that have happened. But it's, you know, the thesis more or less is still there. You know, why don't I'm actually just going to read this is the very opening of the text. And it kind of goes to this. It says, you know, so Bernays says right at the beginning, so the chapter has an interesting title. It's Organizing Chaos. And this is his kind of like base sort of thesis or argument, which is basically the world is chaotic, right? Like our big, wide political, social world, there's hundreds of millions of people. It's kind of a nightmare. How does one package this into a particular direction? So Bernays says, the conscious and intelligent manipulation of organized habits and opinions of the masses is an important element in democratic society. Those who manipulate this unseen mechanism of society constitute an invisible government, which is a true ruling power of the country. That sounds very, what's the word I'm looking for? Orwellian, conspiracist, but we'll get into what, yeah, exactly. And then he goes on to say, we are governed, our minds molded, our tastes formed, our ideas suggested, largely by men we have never heard of. This is a logical result of the way in which our democratic society is organized. Vast numbers of human beings must cooperate in this manner if they are to live together as a smoothly functioning society. So basically, that's where he comes from, is, you know, the world is a chaotic place, society is chaotic. Obviously, we want to have some structure. We want to have things focused. It can't just be like this anarchistic, everybody's like, you know, I have like these political beliefs, I have these interests, and everything's just kind of competing in this wild storm together. His general idea is that, you know, propaganda, as he calls it, is a tool to convince and organize people. in a particular direction. He most famously used this for advertising, basically. And I'm sure we could start by talking about that a little. Like, even to get into it just a little bit, advertising in the early 19th century was pretty, or sorry, throughout up until the early 20th century, was pretty blatant, for lack of a better way of putting it. But yeah, rudimentary, blatant. It was kind of like, you know, my toothpaste is the best toothpaste. No toothpaste makes your teeth, like, cleaner or whatever, right? They were generally claims about the product that was basically meant to, you know, the claim was, the buyer was meant to recognize the claim as being like, oh, well, it's the best toothpaste, so I should buy that toothpaste. Basically, Bernays, so that's kind of like a front-end way of looking at advertising and convincing communities.
I also think
just like, just, oh, go ahead. Yeah.
Interesting too. I think that's how most people see advertising the way it is, even in our own age. When they see an advertisement, it's a straightforward sell.
On some level, it's almost necessary to keep that facade going, because what Bernays, as like we're going to talk about, gets into is basically that you can, that the propagandist can use different tools of influence, oftentimes very like dissipated and fragmented, to kind of come from, instead of being a kind of front-loaded kind of convincing, it comes from the back and makes people think that they, convinces people that they're, the desires that they're having are their own.
Yeah.
And that's, and really...
Also, it also involves the, what I would say, the installation of those desires themselves, right?
Because, yeah, exactly.
Because if, so if what you're, because I think what you're describing is the transition from needs to desires, right? And if you don't have, so we have immediate needs. We have to eat. We have to clothe ourselves. And these are usually the basis on which you would, in this straightforward, front-loaded way, sell someone, right? This food is the most nutritious. This food is the most, you know, you think of the like very kind of naive advertising of, like, I think back when there was a World War I OXO ad that was being sold, because at the time you're shipping things to your loved ones on the front, and the way that you sell OXO to them is you tell them it's invigorating, gives you strength, it keeps you warm, because they're going to sell those to the people who are then going to ship little OXO cubes, OXO being like a powdered beef stock, right? So they send them to the people on the front. That's one way that you see this need driven kind of advertising. And I think it maybe, considering that like historical circumstance, the rudimentary advertising was really important, because you are thinking about, you know, what do I, my loved ones need, or something like that. But it's on the backs of just like very early advertising techniques. But the transition that you're alluding to is not so much, hey, this person needs something. Now people's needs are being met. Now we need to get people to want more than they need.
It's about propaganda, and the book itself is also propaganda, because Bernays is trying to sell this model, convince people that this model is legitimate. You know, already at the time of Bernays writing this work in the 1920s, he talks about it in the work, there was bad connotations around the word propaganda, right? People were already like, you know, propaganda is this kind of suspicious thing. It's the way the government controls people. It's a way that, you know, as Bernays says, the invisible government. Before we get too conspiratorial, like people think, oh, invisible government. I think what Bernays means is basically society's power, brokers, and structures. So like the example, so probably the best example that he gives is the Democratic and Republican Party of the United States. Right, these are real entities. They are not elected. Like, you can be there, they have elections within like the private party system or whatever, but they are not, they're not technically part of like, you know, the public state. But they obviously dictate how the state functions, right? The entire U.S. government is, well, all the elected officials are either Democrats or Republicans, effectively, right? So that obviously these organizations that have their members implanted throughout the state and influence elections and all this kind of stuff, they are going to be Like, they are effectively a kind of invisible government. You know, another option might be like corporations, especially back then, especially now, where you have very large, powerful, you know, private organizations, business organizations that clearly have, you know, an enormous amount of influence on the state and on society, right? So when he's saying invisible government, he's not necessarily saying, like, you know, the Illuminati. He's talking about, I guess, like the real versions of that.
Well, it's interesting because I took the reading of that to be one of, so this is like 1928, and he is trying to sell himself on being a PR consultant. He said the fact that this is propaganda itself, it literally says that on the front cover. He's trying to sell himself to corporations to, hey, I can do this for you. But we can go into that. In any case, I think I took that to, like, I guess I read it more psychologically because the influence of Freud is kind of important for Bernays. So he's operating in an environment where Freud hasn't really hit America yet. So he has to use things that the Americans are familiar with. And one of the things that Americans are familiar with is government, right? It's a democracy. That's how you sell yourself in America. And so he is essentially giving an analogy for what Freud would have called the superego, this aspect of ourselves that is regulated by our group norms, by our and also just the fact that we have to make unconscious decisions, that is, undeliberated decisions. And who makes those decisions? It is something like the fact that our social norms are regulated by a part of ourselves that we learn. For Freud, that part was the superego. And if you violate that superego, the result is guilt, right? You have this voice in your head that tells you how you screwed up or whatever, or how ashamed you should be. So I think that this is just one way of bringing in the psychology of it without having to explain it, maybe even keeping it kind of for himself.
Well, and I think that the split that you're kind of illustrating, the way I think that, like, the simple terms I use for myself is, like, you know, older styles of advertising that were more direct, older styles, yeah, I guess I wouldn't even call it propaganda, really, it's just straight advertising, was directed at you, right? Like, you, the observer, the taker in, it's like, you know, you need the toothpaste. This is the best toothpaste. Like, basically you could read the ad as saying, like, this is the best toothpaste. Brandon, would you buy this toothpaste? Right? Like, it's very directed at, you know, whoever is particularly viewing this piece, right? Conversation between the product and yourself. What Bernays rightly knew or understood was that the target should not be the individual. It's like, the individual as a target is not a good way to create the kind of picture in someone's head that you want. You know, you're dealing with groups, so this is going to be an exercise in group psychology. And so what Bernays does is, you know, propaganda transitions to, instead of focusing on any particular individual, focusing on group aspects and group understandings and all the sort of interlocking layers of those that exist. You know, he goes, at certain parts of the book, he says, you know, like, the United States is made up of groups. Like, and he literally is like, here's, like, the, like, you know, association almanac, just like a tiny portion of, like, A in that, you know, letter A in that almanac. And lists, like, you know, 30 American organizations at the time with the letter A in the Chicago area or whatever, yeah. Right?
He pads out his book by just listing enormous, it's a wall of text, but I think to maybe an earlier reader that would have been impressive, but I just see it as, like, I need to pad this out. I see it as another piece of propaganda.
But I also think it's like, you know, he's trying to say, look, like, there's these targets, right? Like, whether it be automobile enthusiasts or, you know, the art collectors society or whatever. It's like, if you want to target any of these organizations, or, you know, the Albanians of America or whatever, right? You target, like these groups. You try and catch people in these big nets.
Yeah, people's interests are socially vectored in that way. They associate with each other and they socially regulate each other in that way. And there's all kinds of networks to go along.
And like to get into that, like so he and he gives us an example. Probably the most the most obvious example is he talks quite a bit. He's like, you know, there are leaders of society. There's this invisible government. They kind of have this influence. But even in individual groups, there's always going to be leaders. There's going to be people on top. And so it's like the best thing you can do, one of the best things you can do is target the leader, right? So it's to like give an example, you know, let's say I have a car. I'm a truck manufacturer. I make pickup trucks, right? And I recognize that the farmers of America, the agricultural workers, the farm owners of America, are a great target audience. Well, what if I go and make basically gift or give or convince a bunch of people that I would deem to be, you know, sort of leaders in this loose group, right? Whether they're the biggest farmer or maybe they're, you know, some popular public individual, like perhaps even could even be someone like a country musician or something like that, right? And we're going to give them a brand new red truck and they're going to drive around in that truck. We're not going to say anything else. Like, we're not going to do anything else. We just want people in this group to recognize that their leadership is interested in X thing. And because that's their leader, we are now also associating X thing, like, with ourselves, right? I also want the red truck. Like, obviously, this truck. I'm a, you know, Big Tom, the biggest, best farmer that everyone looks up to. He drives the red truck now, so I should be driving the red truck as well. So that's, like, a really crude example, but that's exactly the kind of thing that he's thinking about and talking about when it's like, look, target groups, target, and by targeting groups, target leaders within those groups, right? As the kind of, like, you know, the kind of spearhead for your movement, right?
Yeah. Yeah, because those people also sort of capture, and this goes into the other thing too. Sometimes Bernays says groups don't necessarily have leaders, but you're essentially doing the same thing when you target the leaders. Is what you're trying to do is you're trying to modify the picture or the cliches or the stereotypes that people have about themselves, their self-conception, right? And what this does is it allows you to change their, he says specifically, it changes their customs, right? People don't, again, going back to this whole invisible government thing, people don't always, like, you don't decide on every little thing. You leave it up to unconscious decisions, and we can kind of tinker around with what those unconscious pictures look like. Now the fashion is this. Now you buy a green truck instead of a red truck. Because green, we have an abundance of green. This corporation has a lot of green paint left over from the World War, right? And we want to sell it. So what we're going to do is we're going to consult people, see if there's an actual need for it, which I think more is just like guilt assuasion for Bernays when he's writing anyway, when he says things like, you know, the PR company will do what is... The PR consultant is not going to just sell things to people because they're pointless or if they're harmful. They're actually going to pick things that are useful. That's, I think the history of advertising and of trends shows that that's not always the case. But we can get into that. In any case, what you're doing is you're trying to sell these things to these people by changing their conception of it, right? So say, think about like the iconic colors of John Deere, green and yellow, right? Once you have that brand recognition, you can start selling off all kinds of products in this color because it suits a kind of aesthetic. Farmers want to have a kind of aesthetic. Maybe there is this feeling of like a lost sense of identity among them or something. Maybe if instead of that, maybe it's something like repair, you know, like straight up equipment is like really bad right now. It's like the post-war or something. For some reason, we use this stuff to death. Now we need to give them a new coat of paint. Well, we've got all this green paint laying around. Let's use that. And then you advertise green, 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 green. And now everyone's really happy to pitch in and buy things and revitalize the economy because now they're using new equipment and they all feel, you know, it's just stuff like that. It's supposed to be rather, if it seems organic, it's supposed to seem that way. You are sort of orchestrating organic occurrences in events or cooperations between consumer and the corporations or the companies that are selling these things, right?
Yeah, so to illustrate another example, I actually just thought about talking about what you're saying here, what we're discussing here. Another good example that I can really think about would be Red Bull, the energy drink, right? Because, you know, obviously Red Bull is basically like a caffeine-filled energy drink, right? But they, you know, the target audience, they would say, you know, is probably younger men and there's this, or younger people, and there's this kind of like extreme attitude, the kind of like energized attitude, the kind of like, you know, adventurous or whatever. So, you know, Red Bull obviously has its ads. There's the famous line that Red Bull, like, you know, gives you wings or whatever, you know, kind of like helps you fly, it boosts you up. But really, the biggest thing that Red Bull got into was sponsoring and making extreme sports, right? Like thinking about like the plane racing and like the base jumping and the high speed boat racing and all this kind of stuff. You know, it's all Red Bull presents, you know, little planes flying around a circuit and crashing into the water. It's crazy. It's intense. It's like hyped up. And it's, you know, it builds an association, an idea, or it inserts Red Bull into a association, idea, community. You know, we might talk about like a style of life that it might not otherwise have been there before had it not been connected with these seemingly unrelated activities. Like, you know, like there's nothing actually like drinking an energy drink and being an acrobatics pilot in a race actually have nothing to do with each other.
Yeah. This is the social construction of the relation between these things in a certain way. That was actually something I was kind of thinking about before in terms of like just the materialist aspect of it. Like there's an example that he gives of corset sellers, right? He says a PR consultant would never sell corsets because I'm writing in the sort of suffragette movement and corsets are seen as restrictive. So what I would say is that I would recommend that they go down to, you know, girdles. And I was like, okay, well, what if I'm just like an insurance company? Why don't I just start selling girdles? Right. And there really is a kind of like materialist aspect to it in terms of like, okay, we have the infrastructure to make corsets. It would be like, if we're a life insurance company, we don't want to invest in, you know, corset production or girdle production machines. So I guess that's one way that you can limit it, is like going from selling life insurance to girdles is a lot more expensive than going from girdles or going from corsets to girdles. You just have to not make restrictive garments. You just make garments that women want to buy. So I guess it still has like that. But then in the case of like the Red Bull, well, what's the relationship between that? I guess it's the fact that you can sell it to the audiences there, or I don't know. It's
I think it's more about building, you know, obviously building up the brand, but building like the association of the brand with a particular kind of lifestyle, person, you know, style of life. And it's one that a lot of people want to be associated with. It's fun, it's exciting, it's intense, right? Like, you know, and so, you know, Red Bull is my conduit into this world that I might not actually, this style of life, this culture, that I might actually have zero experience in, but I want to be a part of, right? And that's the, that's the interesting thing about like the group think and focusing on the group is, The members a lot of times need to either just think that they're a part of the group or want to be a part of the group, right? You know, another example would be if I'm, you know, I'm trying to sell some sort of product to, younger men, and let's just say in this case, younger men who are generally seen to be or associated with being single or having difficult romantic lives or whatever, well, then I'm going to pump out a whole bunch of basically sexuality-related content with my product, either directly associated or very distant association, literally just catching, oh, such and such super famous model is using this product. You know, it's been spotted in whatever tabloid website or whatever. Even something like that is a covert way of putting it out there so that even if these individuals don't have that kind of romantic life, it's something that they envision themselves being a part of.